Good morning. I don't know about you, but when someone tells me that I can't do something, the first thing that I want to do is show them exactly how I can do it. So by way of introduction, my name is Lieutenant Colonel retired Mark Bonica. I recently retired from the Army. I was a hospital administrator, medical service corps officer for 23 years, and now happy to be up at the University of New Hampshire where I'm teaching in the health management and policy branch. I worked for a couple of years with my co-author, Lieutenant Colonel Karen Story, who is currently on field training exercises in Germany and sends her regrets for not being able to come here today. She's possibly preparing to go to Afghanistan. Karen and I worked together on a couple of projects, one of which is by way of introduction, one of which was I read about in the Wall Street Journal about this SNAP challenge thing, which I had never heard of before, but I read about this Wall Street Journal columnist wrote about how he did the SNAP challenges. So for those of you that are not familiar with the idea, SNAP challenges, you live on 426 a day, which is the maximum food stamp benefit. And he went on to say how difficult it was. And I'm thinking about it on the way into work, and I'm thinking 426 a day, I think I could do that. Not only do I think I could do that, I think I could do it on less. So actually, for Karen and I set up a challenge where I ate on $3 a day for 30 days. And had some positive, had basically all positive outcomes. But that, by way of introduction, is you know, we blogged about it. It's out there. You can see $3 diet Bonica. It's still out there on the internet if you want to read about it. But more to the point, as my kids, who are teenagers, say, haters are going to hate. And so we got some feedback back on the experiment saying, well, you're a rich white guy living in the suburbs, and you have access to you know, to really nice grocery stores, and you don't have any transportation issues. So what you need to do is live in a food desert, and then you'll know. And so I said to Karen, "What the hell is a food desert?" Because I'm not a public health person. My background is in, like I said, direct care and economics. I have no relationships to disclose, but I am wearing this really cool diabetes tie that I bought the other day from the vendors there. No endorsement, just I thought it was kind of fun. So what is a food desert? I asked Karen, and she says, well, a food desert is an urban or rural town area where the people, because of transportation issues, don't have access to good grocery stores where they can get fresh, healthy, affordable food. Instead of shopping in decent grocery stores, they shop in convenience stores and fast food restaurants. And as a result, they wind up with this really crappy diet that then leads to obesity and other diet-related diseases such as diabetes and heart disease. I said, that sounds awesome, so let's do it. So the questions that we wanted to pose were, if you're living in a food desert, is it possible to put together, so you're shopping just at convenience stores and fast food restaurants, is it possible to put together a healthy, nutritious diet under these conditions? And those conditions include not only where you're shopping, but also a limited income. What are the effects? So ceteris paribus, holding everything else equal, take a healthy person, you drop them in a food desert. What happens to them? Right? And so the question is geography destiny? As my colleague here just said, place matters, and I'll agree with that and more to it in a second. So what were our methods? So into the food desert, a food desert simulation is what we call this. You know, the SNAP challenge is sort of a simulation as well. So I was the subject, no IRB required, 30 days was our time frame. I ate only food that I could buy in a convenience store. I basically ruled out fast food immediately because I knew for the next item, which was I was going to try to spend $7.25 a day, which correlates to about 1 hour minimum wage. Why did we pick that? Well, because, you know, we're talking about the two aspects of food desert. One is you have limited access. The other is you have limited income. So I wanted to pick something, you know, you're picking an arbitrary number. Let's link it to something. I was allowed to, so immediately I ruled out shopping, buying food in a excuse me, fast food restaurant, but I was able to buy food at convenience stores and bring it home and cook it. What did we keep track of? Daily food costs, calories consumed, food, you know, calories in and out, weight gain, clinical labs, did a pre and a post lab to measure cholesterol and blood sugar, to capture, so obviously we're going to keep track of weight gain, obesity, cholesterol for heart disease, and blood sugar for diabetes. We kept a fairly detailed food diary on our blog here, Into the Food Desert, which is still out there, and you can read about what we did. So I set about trying to make healthy choices in this limited environment. food that tasted good, because to me, part of coming up with a sustainable diet is the food's got to taste okay, right? If I'm eating junk every day, I don't want to live like that. So trying to have food that tastes good and is relatively inexpensive. As you can see, this is how I kept track of everything, weighed everything as I went along. Is my itty bitty canister of peanut butter that I was able to buy in a convenience store instead of a bigger scale one, which is part of the problem of shopping in food deserts. So what were our results? Well, as you might imagine, the diet was limited and expensive, repetitive and carb heavy. This is me eating my lunch at my desk. Repetitive. Once I kind of solved the problem of what can I afford? What's healthy or reasonably healthy? Ate a lot of it. So peanut butter and banana sandwiches became a kind of a staple for me in this diet. One of the things that I didn't expect, but Karen pointed out to me after she did the nutritional analysis, was over the course of the 30 days, I gradually increased the amount of sugar I was eating. Now, part of that is because I'm a junk food junkie at heart, and I have a massive sweet tooth. But I didn't, I was really trying to be conscientious about what I was eating, and it just kind of drifted like that. So some of, when you're under stress and you're trying to do that, some of that stuff just happens. So measuring out costs. To orient you to the slide here, the blue bars represent what I actually spent day to day buying my food. This is the actual food resources used. The green bars are I took the same food that I bought in a convenience store and then repriced it in a local grocery store, real grocery store. So you can see the differential between what it would have cost, right? The red bar going across, it was my 725 targets. You can see kind of how I fluctuated around it. Most days I was okay. I was between $5 and $10 on most days, right? Except for 2 days, you can see stand out there. Day 12, which is that first kind of big bar, I hit almost $20. That was a day I was driving to Western Mass to go visit my daughter who's going to school out there. I got lost on the way. It wound up taking like 3 hours longer than I'd planned on being. And, I'm driving around in circles and I'm just getting really frustrated. And I wind up going to a convenience store and buying a pre-made sandwich, my one bag of chips that I ate during those 30 days, and a big old tea, right? Totally unhealthy, but also really expensive. So kind of when something happens, when you're on this kind of limited diet, when something unexpected happens, all hell breaks loose, right? So that was one example. The other one, it was actually kind of intentional. And I'll show you that in a second. But this one I said, and maybe I was getting a little crazy on after about 25 days of this kind of diet. But I said to myself, what could I do if I kind of like turned off the expense, valve and said, what could I do what kind of dinner could I make? Only buying ingredients that I can buy in convenience stores, right? And so I called up, I had a couple, my family was still living in Texas at the time, so I'm there up in New Hampshire by myself. So I called up a couple of friends, there are a couple of lawyers that never cook, and I said, I'm inviting myself over for dinner on Friday night. I'm gonna cook for you, but the hitch is that everything I cook for you is gonna come from a convenience store. And they kind of like, okay. They said, but you're gonna cook for us, right? And I said, yes. And they said, all right, well, game. So what did I cook? Did I mention that I'm in New Hampshire I'm about 5 minutes from the Maine coast. So we had lobster, handmade gnocchi, it's a potato pasta, handmade gnocchi with a white wine, cream sauce, garden salad, brownie a la mode, cost me $32. All of what you see came from a convenience store, including the lobster, which came from a gas station. So things are possible. And what's kind of crazy about this result here is it's actually easier to eat lobster and gourmet ice cream from a convenience store than it is to eat healthy. So calories. The blue bars going up were my calories that I consumed each day. On average, I consumed 1,875 calories, which is not an unreasonable diet. The red bars going down indicate the amount of excess calories that I burned as a result of exercise. I had a foot injury during that period. I normally like to run, but I was just walking. So what you can see here is kind of net calories, 1527. Based on NIH, I'm a 5'8" male. I should weigh 144 pounds. 144 pound male needs to have a minimum of 1500 calories a day just to maintain weight. Add on exercise, and so what you can see is I was right in the target range for adequate calories to maintain maintain my weight. However, I wasn't a 144-pound male. I'm not sure how many people actually fit into the normal body mass index, but that's a whole other story. I started out at 175 pounds, ended at 163 pounds, so I lost 12 pounds in this 30-day period. Right, so obesity was one of the things that the food desert literature talks about. It didn't happen. So now let's address the outcomes with regards to with regards to heart disease and diabetes. So you see those first. So these are my pre and post labs. So I had blood drawn before and after. So the first column is the pre. So this is what my cholesterol going into the experiment was 168 for serum cholesterol. Post was 169, so the difference is negligible. HDL, that's your good cholesterol, no change. LDL is your bad cholesterol. Actually got better in the 30 days that I was on this diet. Triglycerides is another form of dietary fat. You can see it went up significantly, but it's still well within the control range. Triglycerides are very sensitive to kind of what you ate in the last 24, 48 hours. So, you know, one could ask, well, you know, when I did the pre, did I, was I just kind of being good for the 24 hours into it? I don't remember and I didn't keep track. You know, and so maybe it's really hard to say. This is one of the weaknesses of this experiment was it's only 30 days and it was only me, right? So we don't have a lot of data. This is just kind of, you know, let's see what happens. A1C and glucose measure are your standard measures for diabetes. Glucose, like triglycerides, is very responsive, of course, to whatever you've eaten in the last 12 hours or so, right? Okay, but it did get a little better. A1C is a much better measure. It's a longitudinal measure, right? This is what you're going to measure if you're trying to decide if you have diabetes. This is the number you need to see. It did go up. It ticked up a bit, not massively, still within the safe range. So here I say, you know, we see some ambivalence here in these labs, but largely they're not pointing towards significantly decreased health outcomes. Where my experiment fails is right here. And this is where, you know, I kind of went back and forth with Karen about this. I'm like, well, what about this and that? And she's like, no, you're wrong. And it's good to have a partner that will say that to you, right? So where my experiment fails is here in the micronutrients. And you can see, so these numbers represent the percent of the micronutrient that I was actually able to consume during my 30-day experiment. And you can see, so for example, vitamin D. I only got 13% of what was recommended, the recommended daily allowance for vitamin D, and there's a bunch of other ones here. So what that says to me is this stuff wasn't available. I was doing my best to make a healthy diet from the things that I could buy in these stores. And, you know, this is where Karen said, you did your best, you failed. So this is it, right? So this is kind of, this to me is where we have to admit defeat, or I have to admit defeat. Karen was, you know, fine with it. But something else that was interesting that kind of came out as a, you know, so I'm an economist, this is, you know, so I love numbers. And so we're looking at some of the costs, the comparative costs of what these things actually cost. So you can see the first column is the price that I pay for these things in a convenience store. The second column is what they cost, these same things would have cost in the local grocery store. And what's interesting is, so I bought an orange for 99 cents in a convenience store, and I could have bought that same orange for 79 cents in a grocery store, about a 25% premium, right? Green pepper, same thing, about 43% premium. Not that big. But when you start looking at some of the other stuff that really kind of became the core of my diet, right? Massive multiples, right? I bought this oatmeal tin, you know, this a canister of oatmeal, cost me $4.19 in a convenience store. I could have bought that same thing for a little over a dollar in a regular store. Now the story here is not that oranges and green peppers were more affordable. It's that oranges and green peppers are more expensive, period, right? And these other things are relatively more expensive when you buy them in a convenience store. So fresh food is just more expensive, period. And I'll talk to that in a second here a little more. So my thoughts coming out of this, the results of this relatively short experiment, and we address the limitations more extensively in the paper that we're putting together here. But I would say, is geography destiny? Well, yes and no, right? We have a bunch of shortfalls, one of them being, you know, N of 1, 30 days. But yes, right? 43% premium. If you're poor and you're having to shop in stores where it's a 43% premium, that just makes your situation worse. But more importantly is the micronutrients just weren't there. Right? There's no way to economize around something that's not there. So if you can't get it, then, you know, that to me is a problem. Now, on the no side, I said, well, you know, calories in, calories out. That's how you control weight. There's really kind of no, in, you know, there's really no kind of two sides to this. You want to lose weight, you eat less calories. The lab's kind of, you know, fairly supportive of the fact that, you know, the real problem seems to be, in the long run, that it's the micronutrients. So some of the policies that I see proposed as I've been reviewing the literature on food deserts seem to be very focused on getting fresh foods to these neighborhoods. And my thinking is really we're kind of missing the focus. The focus really ought to be on how do we get more cheap micronutrient-rich food into these neighborhoods. And so what I would imagine, what I would have really liked while I was on this diet would have been access to some frozen foods, because eating canned peas sucks. I will tell you that I ate a lot of them, and they're really terrible. And I finally found some frozen peas, and it was like, you know, I was like, oh, this tastes so much better. And frankly, the quality, right, the nutritional value between canned versus frozen is dramatic, but the difference between the nutritional difference between frozen and fresh is actually almost, you know, is they're very, very close. And the main advantage of frozen and or dried is that frozen doesn't have the kind of costs to the store that fresh does, right? Because fresh spoils. If you don't sell it in a couple of days, it's gone, it's waste, right? Frozen, you don't sell it today or next week, well, it's gonna hang, it can probably hang around for a couple of months. So, you know, one of the things I did was, you know, I went to Walmart and I found a 5-pound bag of mixed vegetables. You know, I've got, you know, in there I've got carrots and peas and green beans and a bunch of other stuff for $6, right? Part of the problem in these convenience stores is scale, but also, you know, you can get much better nutrition from frozen. So one of the things I would ask is, you know, as we look at trying to find policy solutions to the food desert, one of the things, rather than trying to push a very expensive solution, which is getting fresh, why aren't we pushing something that's more realistic, probably more sustainable in terms of an actual business model, which is getting frozen and dried. So that was another weird thing that kind of caught me by surprise. I couldn't find a dried bean anywhere in any of the convenience stores that I happen to shop in. Now that might be true in other places. Again, you know, it's a limited geographic location, but that was kind of some of the challenges I saw. And then kind of finally in conclusion, again, because I'm an economist, you know, one of the things I ask is, well, if people want fresh foods and vegetables in these areas, what's stopping some entrepreneur from delivering them? And so my hypothesis, without doing further research, without having done the research at this point, would be, I'm suspecting that it's probably zoning issues and that it's probably licensing issues of some sort. But that, you know, at this point, that's kind of where I would want to look further. So thank you for your time. Happy to answer questions afterwards.